Philip, thanks for talking with us.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure.
So you're not reporting from Russia now, but you have in the past. And I'm curious, your observations, things that stick out in your mind when you look at what's taking place now with Russia and Ukraine.
Yes, I spent 4 years working out of Moscow, covering the former Soviet Union for the British newspaper, The Independent. That was during the 1990s. And when I was posted there, obviously, like any correspondent, I began to research the subject and researched, of course, the personality and character of Boris Yeltsin, the president at the time. And I arrived in Moscow more or less expecting him to be a reformer who was leading a country from communism along a path of reform towards democracy. The reality on the ground turned out to be very different, though. I mean, what I found was a president who shelled his own democratically elected parliament, a president who launched a war against the tiny Republic of Chechnya, which wanted to join other former Soviet republics and secede from Russia. I found a president who was presiding over a period in which vast amounts of state assets were being commandeered by the people who became the oligarchs that we all know today and whose money is distributed across the map today. A president who altered the constitution and rigged the 1996 election. Boris Yeltsin wasn't, in my view, much of a Democrat or a reformer, but he's still seen that way today. And the reason I'm telling all this is because I think we got Russia wrong then, and I think we might be getting it wrong now.
Tell me more.
Well, to understand what's going on in Ukraine and Crimea, and this is without passing judgment about the morality, the rights and wrongs of it, but you do have to try to see it from the Russian perspective, just as you have to understand the Western perspective. Otherwise, the story doesn't make any sense. And when you look at how Russia views the landscape from their end of the telescope, take, for example, Crimea. Crimea, to them, is the place where their first national saint, St. Vladimir, was baptized. Ukraine was the place where Russian Orthodox Christianity originally took root. In Crimea, during the mid-19th century, the French and the British fought a ferocious war with the Russians, who, surprise, surprise, were trying to expand towards the Ottoman Empire. French and the British wanted to stop that. The Russians held out there in the city of Sevastopol for 11 months. They held out in the same city during the Second World War, against the advancing Nazi forces. You had the Soviet Red Army making a stand that critically delayed the advance of the Nazis onto Stalingrad. After the war, the Soviet Union gave Sevastopol the title of City of Heroes, a hero city, they called it. So this, my point is that this is all very important historical material from the point of view of the relationship that the Russians feel they have with the place. When you add to that the fact that it's the base of their Black Sea Fleet, the fact that their sailors, retired servicemen, retired naval officers are down there every summer in the sanatorium, sitting on the stony beaches of the Black Sea, relaxing, and the fact that 60% of the population of Crimea are Russian by ethnicity, then you can see why the Russians consider that to be their terrain. Whether that's right or wrong, legally it's part of independent sovereign Ukraine, but in the Russian mind, it's still very much tied to them and to their history. And that's part of the thinking that they're bringing to bear in this particular very important confrontation and conflict that is in the making in that part of the landscape at the moment.
Did what's happened in the last few weeks, did it surprise you in any way?
It did surprise me in that the language that was used to describe it seemed to me to be extremely toxic. I'm not sure we are correct when we invoke the Cold War to describe what is going on here. I mentioned earlier Yeltsin. I was working in Moscow, Yeltsin used to jokingly refer to himself as Tsar Boris. I think there was an element of truth in that. I think what we're witnessing is much more to do with that period in Russian history rather than the Soviet period in Russian history. I've been surprised by the tendency also to portray this as a small country of 46 million people, not very small, but when you compare it to the size of Russia, it is, that's universally determined to become part of the European Union and is being stopped by the bully boy, Putin. I find that rather simplistic. I wouldn't want to be an apologist for Putin. Who would? But I think there are shades of grey in here that we must take into account when we reflect on this situation.
There are loyalties to Russia by many in Ukraine.
There are indeed, yes. Very close. Their histories are entwined and have been entwined for centuries. To present it as a black and white conflict in which sort of pro-European Democrats are confronted with Cold War warriors from the East, I think is getting it wrong.
What will you be watching for with this tension in the coming weeks?
Well, obviously, the great risk is that this will evolve into a straight-out confrontation between the south and east of Ukraine on one hand, particularly Crimea, and the west of Ukraine. And every diplomatic effort is going to be made, I think, to stop that from happening because it's potentially extremely dangerous. And so I think what we all should be keeping our eye on at the moment is the diplomacy. It's going to be very tricky to go along this path because there are no simple solutions. People have been talking about sanctions, visa restrictions, scrutinizing the source, for example, of the vast amount of money that some of the Russians have distributed in banks all over Europe and I'm sure the US as well. But I'm not sure there are any levers that can be pulled that fix this. And one has to remember that if you pull a lever, the another lever will be pulled in Moscow. So everything that happens is going to have an effect. And it's a tricky, tricky path that they now must negotiate their way along in order to stop, what could be a civil war in the heart of Europe. And that could evolve into a very bloody mess.
Now, you used to report in Russia, but now you're with NPR and you're in Pakistan. Tell me what you're reporting on. What is sort of top of mind there right now?
I've just moved to Islamabad to report Pakistan from there after a shortish stint working out of London covering Europe. But I have been there before a number of times. I was the Delhi correspondent for NPR for a number of years. So to some extent, it's familiar terrain for me, although there's always something to be learned and there's always something new on the landscape. I think the core issue in Pakistan at the moment really is the possible consequences of the withdrawal from Afghanistan of US and NATO forces, a process that's already begun and a process that could lead to the complete departure of the Americans if a security deal isn't signed by President Karzai of Afghanistan as the Americans would like. Pakistan is extremely concerned about what this might mean for them, not least because in their memories is the withdrawal of the United States and its support after the Soviets left Afghanistan in 1989. Pakistan worked with the CIA and with the Saudis to support the jihadis, among them Osama bin Laden, who were used to fight the Soviet army in Afghanistan. Everybody left, and the Pakistanis feel that they were left to deal with the consequences of that, which were militancy, militants sort of scattered across the landscape, and refugees from Afghanistan, more of whom came in the civil war that happened in the early 90s in Afghanistan and took root in Pakistan. And they're worried that there'll be another surge of these if the very fragile situation in Afghanistan really degenerates. It is more complex. There's no doubt the Pakistanis have supported certain elements that have been confronting U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is right in their backyard. It's extremely unstable. They want a stake in the contest for influence in that area when the U.S. and NATO finally withdraw. So they have a crucial interest there. And their great worry, of course, is that in Afghanistan, India, their old enemy, will become extremely influential. In their imagination, they see the possibility of having India on the east and an Indian ally on their western flank as well, in effect surrounding them. And so there's great concern about that.
And for those who don't follow news in this area very closely, why is that important? Why not have a strong India on either side?
Well, it's important partly because these two countries have a history of conflict and they both have nuclear weapons, and partly because anything that encourages the growth of Islamist fundamentalism in Pakistan is likely to worsen an already serious situation. Let's remind, you know, it's important to remember that in Pakistan there is already an insurgency underway in which the Pakistani Taliban, who are separate from the Afghan Taliban, are fighting the state in the hope of creating in the northwest of Pakistan an area that's governed by Sharia rule and with the ambition of imposing Sharia law across the entire landscape. There is also a very serious insurgency in the biggest and poorest province, Baluchistan, and to that we should also add a sectarian conflict between elements of the Sunni majority and the Shia, who form 15% of the population. Into the mix, there's serious economic problems. Pakistanis do not have a regular supply of electricity. Some places get a couple of hours a day. Some places go for days in the summer without power. There are power cuts in the capital regularly. When I'm working in my office, the generator goes on and off because the city power supply is being cut. They're also suffering severe shortages of gas for their stoves and for heating their homes. So this is a country that's fundamentally struggling to function. Anything that adds to the problems that are already on their plates has to be bad news for Pakistan.
And it seems like there's internal tension, too, as far as what role the military should play.
There is a degree of anxiety about whether the military can be effectively used to solve some of the problems that I've outlined, in particular to deal with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda affiliated groups that are still operating out of the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan, the tribal belt. There is an element in Pakistan who strongly argue that the only way to root out these militants and to stop them attacking Pakistanis, tens of thousands of people have died in that conflict in recent years, is to launch a military operation in North Waziristan and flush them out. It's more complicated than that, though, and there are other voices who say that that will lead to indiscriminate civilian casualties and that the Taliban will reply by attacking the Punjab, the state where the majority of Pakistanis live and where the army and government has its bases, and also, most importantly, the city of Karachi, where the Taliban are now deeply rooted. It's the economic hub of the country. And to add to the chronic violence that's been going on in that city for many years, more violence orchestrated by the Taliban, attacks on government officials and on policemen will do potentially great economic damage to Pakistan, who's already struggling to get its economy in order, and that could spell disaster.
Just a few more questions.
Sure.
Do you feel safe as a journalist reporting in Pakistan?
I wouldn't say that I feel safe working in Pakistan in certain areas of the landscape. If I go to them at all, I do so with great caution, and I don't go to them often. Elsewhere, though, I personally don't feel the existence of a threat that I know theoretically is there, but I suspect is not as... Let me just start this answer again. It doesn't compare with working in Iraq. I did a number of months in Iraq for NPR, and there the threat was all around you, and it was extremely hard just to, you know, move around and talk to people in the landscape and in Baghdad in particular, because we were clearly targeted, and there was a very high level of violence going on in the immediate vicinity where the media were working. Pakistan isn't quite like that. Having said that, just recently there's been a very nasty attack in the middle of Islamabad, the capital of the country, and that served as a reminder that there are dangers out there. I am very cautious before I go into any of the areas, particularly in the northwest, where the Taliban are very active, and their allies. But there are large parts of Pakistan, as there are in any conflict zone, that just carry on. And you can move carefully and respectfully through those places, talking to people. The Pakistanis are extremely accommodating and courteous, I've found, and do so without feeling under immediate threat.
Does it help that you don't have an American accent?
I don't know how much people are aware of the distinction between British and American accents. I suppose there are amongst the sort of metropolitan, cosmopolitan Pakistanis those who would immediately notice the difference between my accent and yours, because they travel to London. Many of them have relatives in London, and they also have families in the US. Many Pakistanis would have no idea what my nationality is. I think they would probably assume I was either British or American. And I would also add that in the minds of those who belong to a sizable, perhaps a majority of Pakistanis, who have some degree of anti-Western feelings, I don't know how much it matters whether you're Brit or an American. I mean, they remember the British role in Afghanistan, and they remember the British role in Iraq very clearly, and Britain's role also in sort of laying down the structure of today's Middle East. And so you don't get treated with any extra degree of, affection if you happen to be from the UK. And of course, the other huge factor here is this is part of the former British India, and the British legacy in Pakistan, of course, is very varied, from the judiciary, which is totally dysfunctional in Pakistan, to certain commercial and political institutions. You meet people who are quite surprisingly wistful about the days of the British Empire, but you also meet those who are very glad it's over and are liable to remind you, if you're a Brit, of the role you played in their landscape and what they view to be a highly exploitative role.
So you live in Islamabad, is that right, with your family?
I live in Islamabad, not with my family. They are in the UK. In the UK. Journalists and diplomats there generally don't bring their families at the moment. That is a reflection of the situation. But it's a surprisingly easy city to work in some ways. There are roadblocks, there are police reinforcements, you see a lot of razor wire, you see a lot of blast barriers. But at the same time, it's resembles something of a cross between a university campus or a large modern suburb. It's got wide roads. It's laid out on a grid. So it's pretty easy to get around. And in Islamabad, you do find a lot of people who've played quite leading roles, usually in the military or in government, and who are now in retirement, but know a lot about it. So you can. There are a lot of people to talk to there who can help a person like me try to unravel a complicated story.
And for the listener out there who wonders, what does an NPR international correspondent do when they're not reporting? I guess the question is, A, are you ever not reporting? And B, what do you do for fun?
I'll tell you what I do for fun. I'm trying to learn the piano by ear. I've never had a lesson, and I'm too old to care whether I'm any good at it. So I have a piano in my office in Islamabad. Actually, I have two pianos in Pakistan. I had another one, which when I left to go elsewhere, I gave to a Pakistani colleague, and he took it off to the northwest frontier, where there are a lot of people who don't particularly favor music, let alone pianos, and it's still out there somewhere. So I am stuck with my other piano in Islamabad, and I pummel away at that in the evenings, and it's a very good way of relaxing and unwinding in a place where there aren't a vast number of alternatives. Having said that, the diplomatic expatriate community does have places around and about Islamabad where they do go and unwind and chat and stuff, and so it is possible to do that if you so choose, but it's busy. There's a lot going on, and those opportunities don't avail themselves. The other thing you can do if you're in Pakistan and have a minute to spare or need to relax is watch cricket. The Pakistanis are absolutely fanatical about cricket, as are the other South Asian nations, with the possible exception of the Nepalis. And I am too, so I do sit in front of the TV watching the Pakistani national team play cricket and enjoy it very much.
Well, Philip, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.